start spreading the news. I'm leaving today. I want to be part
the WWRL Morning Show.
Fireworks Day in the greatest city in the world. Happy 4th of July to all y'all. Holding steady at 77 degrees outdoors, going up to a high of 93. With now, AC, they changed this in the last half hour. I said 40% chance of rain. Now they're saying 60. That's more than half, so get ready. Bring your umbrellas if you're out in the street. Right now, it's a pleasure to welcome to our microphones adjunct professor of history and political science at Florida Atlantic University. He's also a blogger, blogging at the website theprogressiveprofessor.com. That's theprogressiveprofessor, all one word, .com. Let's say good morning to Dr. Ronald Fineman. How are you, sir?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much for joining us. Let's start out our discussion about the executive branch, perhaps at the very beginning. How do you see the founding fathers' view of the presidency?
All right. They saw the presidency as an essential branch of government, due to the bad experience in not having a true executive branch under the Articles of Confederation from 1781 to 1789. So what they did is they modeled the presidency on the New York governorship model. The New York governorship model, the strongest governorship set up in any of the 13 states after the Declaration of Independence.
Mm-hmm.
However, they made sure to create checks and balances and division of authority so that the Congress and the courts would be counterbalancing government branches. So the president, therefore, only had a four-year term, could face impeachment if he was seen as violating the Constitution of the United States, was elected not by popular vote of the masses, because of fear of that, but rather by the Electoral College.
Mm-hmm.
They also put in George Washington as the president because they knew that he was safe and that he was going to preserve the whole concept of the Constitution, and therefore they felt he was the right person for the time. All right, but, therefore George Washington was an insurance policy, so like for the office. certainly was, and I think he was the perfect person to be there.
Yeah.
But also, the Constitution was set up so that the president was limited. His nominations for his cabinet could be rejected by the U.S. Senate. The Congress passed the laws, not the president. And indeed, if the president vetoed the law, the Congress could override the veto by a two-thirds vote.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, treaties. Yes, the president could negotiate treaties, but he would need a two-thirds vote of the Senate for ratification. So therefore, these were all kinds of checks and balances on the office.
Now, was the president from the very beginning the commander-in-chief of the armed forces?
Yes, he was, although in the 1790s there wasn't much thought of having much of a foreign policy because we were a weak nation and we had to deal with major powers like Great Britain, France, and Spain.
Ah, okay. And tell us a little bit about how you see the evolution of presidential power. Moving forward, sure.
Okay, sure. I would say that the major way that presidential power grew was because of crisis, whether it was internal or external. That's what did it. And I would say it actually began with George Washington and the Whiskey Rebellion, where he reacted with federal troops to overcome that rebellion in Pennsylvania in 1794.
Mm-hmm.
Another example, which luckily didn't go too far, was Andrew Jackson threatening to invade South Carolina during the so-called nullification crisis in 1832-33. A third was the plan of Zachary Taylor in 1850, if need be, to indeed invade the South if they had indeed seceded from the Union. It turned out he died instead, and Millard Fillmore negotiated a compromise, the Compromise of 1850,
mm-hmm.
to delay the Civil War. But then, of course, Lincoln obviously took action when the South seceded and fired on Fort Sumter in April 1861. All right, so those were ways that the office grew, but then it actually declined after Lincoln's death.
Wait a minute, let me stop you there for a second,
yeah.
Professor. When it came to the Civil War, Yes. Did President Lincoln go through the Congress at the time to get the authorization to commence the, or actually to respond, I guess, to the shelling of Fort Sumter?
Well, he called Congress at special session, but he actually ordered a reaction to Fort Sumter without a declaration of war. The Civil War was never declared, actually.
Ah, really? Never declared?
There was never a declaration of war. No, we've only had five declarations of war ever in our history, and those are the War of 1812, the Mexican War, the Spanish-American War, and World Wars I and II. Nothing after World War II, 1941, have we ever declared war.
Now, is that I seem to remember, at least during a couple of conflicts, people questioning whether or not the president really had the authority to move forward with the conduct of war without going to the Congress. How has that part of it evolved?
Well, it has evolved in a very dangerous way because Lyndon Johnson got a joint resolution after the Tonkin Gulf incident in August 1964. But the point is that it was not seen as a declaration of war by Congress, but he took it as the authority to indeed expand the war in Vietnam as much as he wanted. And Richard Nixon followed through in the same way without any actual resolution of Congress. And then, of course, that continued to happen in other situations, whether you call them wars or interventions, like, for instance, the intervention in Grenada by Ronald Reagan in 1983, mm-hmm. and the invasion of Panama by George H.W. Bush in 1989, and also the intervention, of course, in Kosovo in 1999 and Bosnia in 1995 by Bill Clinton. These were all without actual joint resolution or really much debate on the part of Congress, and also the interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan, the same way, based on faulty evidence.
And Libya, too, huh?
And Libya also, yes, under Barack Obama, you're right.
Incredible. Now, what other ways have presidents expanded their powers outside the purview of war or outside the purview of military conflict?
All right, well, since the progressive era, since the time of Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, the belief of many so-called liberal presidents or progressive presidents has been that the government should do whatever it can to regulate the economy in the interests of the masses by regulating big business and by promoting government agencies. So, for instance, under Teddy Roosevelt, we got the Food and Drug Administration, mm-hmm. and under Woodrow Wilson, we got the Federal Trade Commission, as an example. And, of course, a great expansion of presidential authority under Franklin Roosevelt during the Great Depression of the 1930s. And then, of course, obviously in the Cold War era under Harry Truman and after, a great expansion of the security state, as we call it, which is still existing today. And, of course, Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society obviously is going way beyond the New Deal. And I think Barack Obama is trying to go beyond the New Deal and the Great Society. And despite all the critics, I think he's done a fantastic job.
Now, wasn't Harry Truman the one that got all the flack about nationalizing, what was it, the oil industry or something?
The steel industry.
Steel industry, yes. Yeah.
The Supreme Court case, but they shut him down. They said he could not do that. So occasionally the Supreme Court has intervened to stop an action of a president. But interesting, in this recent case about the health care plan, they did the opposite to the surprise of many.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, have presidents actually ceded, other than, by order of the judicial branch, have presidents actually ceded power or kind of contracted their power in any way that you've been able to see?
I would say no, except that when the court tells them you can't do something, they back off. But they don't declare a retreat, I don't think. And I think the office, really, whether you have a liberal, progressive president or a conservative president, it keeps on growing. And that's why my dissertation advisor many years ago, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., wrote that famous book in 1973 called The Imperial Presidency.
Yeah.
And that was relating to Nixon's Watergate scandal and the growth of the office. But I would argue that after Nixon left, Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter was a period of lessening of executive power almost automatically because of Watergate and the Vietnam conflict. But I think beginning with Ronald Reagan, it started to grow again, and he was a conservative president, and so was George H.W. Bush, and so was George W. Bush, and I think George W. Bush really expanded the office in some ways, I guess you'd say necessarily, to do so, but in other ways not.
Well, it's interesting because you mentioned Harry Truman and the security state, and
yes.
Some people would argue that George W. Bush kind of sort of did the same thing with the Patriot Act in the wake, obviously, of 9/11. True?
Yes, and by the way, of course, we know that George W. Bush wishes and hopes, which I think is quite funny, that someday, of course, after his death, he will be regarded as highly as Harry Truman, who had a low public opinion rating when he left, but now is, of course, seen as, in most polls, our fifth greatest president.
Sure.
I think George W. Bush is delusional, but I think he'd like to hope that.
Tell me, what do you think the Tea Party, what impact has the Tea Party had on the Obama presidency? Because I'm not sure a president has ever had to confront this kind of third force like this before. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, I think it's very difficult. I think the Tea Party has managed to bottleneck much of the progress on economic revival in this past year and a half. It has forced the debt and deficit crisis last summer, which lowered the credit rating of the U.S. government. And they have fought against so-called Obamacare, which was seen as derisive, but I think it's going to be a great name to be used in the future, Obamacare, you know, instead of calling it Affordable Care Act. And, of course, they have made it clear they will not agree to any tax increases of any kind, and their desire to cut the budget and privatize Medicare and Social Security. And a lot of these people are so far to the right. I mean, the old Republican Party was a party you could actually like elements of it. I remember 30, 40 years ago, they were senators like Charles Percy of Illinois.
Oh, yeah, Jacob Javits here in New York.
Jacob Javits of New York, Charles Mathias of Maryland, Mark Hatfield of Oregon. And they were indeed decent and reasonable, and I actually liked them. But now, I mean, it's very hard. I mean, I think right now we'd say Susan Collins is sort of like all right.
Yeah.
And Olympia Snow, who's leaving. Not much else in that party. And instead, we look at the Tea Party or its allies, particularly in the House, like Michelle Bachmann of Minnesota, enough to give you an upset stomach. Joe Walsh of Illinois, who's attacking Tammy Duckworth on her military experience, including losing both legs. I think it's despicable. And this guy actually owes money to his wife for child support, his ex-wife.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like $125,000. Alan West, which is not my congressman, but the neighboring congressman. I'm so thankful I have Ted Deutsch, my congressman. But this guy is moving to a different district, and Patrick Murphy, his Democratic opponent, really needs everybody to help him out in the Northern Palm Beach, Martin, and St. Lucie district to get rid of Alan West, because this guy's a nightmare.
You know, we got listeners down that way. We get calls from people down Port St. Lucie.
Why do you think I'm saying this? I know what I'm doing.
Dr. Feynman, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for getting up early, huh?
Sure, I appreciate it. I had a great time. I thank you very much.
All right, happy 4th of July to you.
Same to you.
Take care. Dr. Ronald Feynman, adjunct professor of history and political science at Florida Atlantic University. Love that Florida accent, hey, see? He sounds pure D Brooklyn, to tell you the truth. He's also a blogger. He blogs at the website theprogressiveprofessor.com. You should check him out. Progressiveprofessor.com. So have recent U.S. presidents gone too far in expanding the powers of their office? I'd love to hear from you on this 4th of July at 212-868-0975. 212-868-0975. So let's start with Ronald Reagan. There's Bush 1, H.W., Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, President Obama. Have they gone too far?
1600. Fellas, I'm ready to get up and do my thing. I want to get into it, man, you know.
Go ahead.
Like a sex machine.
Access granted.
1, 2, 3, 4.
The Morning Show.
Get up. 212-868-0975.